Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Get around the radio, kids. It's time for Strictly Confidential. It's the homosexual agenda on steroids, putting the Dominionists and the loyal Bushies and the rest of America's underbelly on notice that the GLBT community is simply not going to take it anymore. So, just like gay kryptonite, here's Peter Godbold.
Good evening, America, and good morning, world. Welcome to a very irregular book, chapter, and verse 172 of Strictly Confidential. I am Peter Godbold, and welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio exclusively right here on the listener-supported Head On Radio Network, also brought to you in part by Coal River Mountain Watch at crmw.net. Please stop by crmw.net, Coal River Mountain Watch, and see for yourself what mountaintop removal is doing to West Virginia. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day, today being Wednesday, August 6, 2008. So if you're listening shortly after 9 p.m. Eastern Time on a Wednesday evening, August 6, you are listening to a live show, and you're welcome to phone in and participate with myself and the guest whom I'll be introducing shortly. You're also welcome to join us in chat or via email. I'll tell you more about that in a moment. The show site is strictlyconfidentialradio.com, and it is there that you'll find links to all of the guests and to the audio archives from past shows. You'll find links there to the chat room, which is very easy to get into. Just click on chat room, choose yourself a chat name, and you'll fall right in. There are links there also for Strictly Confidential's MySpace page, and links to help you locate the music that you hear on this show. You'll also find at strictlyconfidentialradio.com links to the Head On Radio Network main site. And at the headonradionetwork.com main site, you can find out about all of the other progressive programming on the Head On Radio Network, of which I am only a small part. You'll also find at headonradionetwork.com the PayPal buttons to make it easier for you to support listener-supported Head On Radio Network and keep progressive radio on the air. I want to let you know that the toll-free line is 877, the number 4, Head On. Again, 877-4, Head On. That translates into 877-443-2366. If you have unlimited long distance, you could use that. The number for that is 304-658-3333. Again, the toll line, 304-658-3333. Both of those ring in West Virginia, and either Bob or Agnes will grab the phone. Email normally arrives to peter@headonradionetwork.com. However, because of some Internet issues this evening, I'm going to be using web-based mail. So if you wouldn't mind sending your emails this evening only to pgodbold@yahoo.com. That's pgodbold@yahoo.com. That's for this evening only. As I said at the very beginning, in most irregular show, the Internet here in my little region has been really slow since Sunday. It has been reported to Embark, the world's most horrible phone company, yet they still scratch their heads and spit on the ground and say, well, gee, we just can't figure out what it is. In fact, the Internet is so slow that it is not possible for me to communicate the studio via the headphones and the high-quality connection and the microphones that we normally use. So, indeed, if this show sounds a little odd to you, it is because I am, in fact, doing this show via a regular telephone, just like all the other callers who call into this radio network. So that's the scoop this evening. Anyway, we're glad to be here. One way or another, glad to be here. Missed you the last couple of days. I've had a little bit of bronchitis, but I am feeling much better. And as it turns out with the Internet, the way it is, we would have had difficulty presenting the show in any case. I want to welcome our guest this evening. Our guest this evening is the third in a series of guests from Dream Spinner Press who write gay fiction or gay erotica. And indeed, our guest this evening, Madeline Urban, will be joining us here in just a moment. Madeline describes herself as a down-home country Kentucky girl who's been writing since she could hold a crayon. She says she's a longtime science fiction and fantasy fan, and she loves to mix those genres with romance, and she normally gets very explosive results. She lives with a partner and two canine kids, and they visit Disney World at least twice a year, and she still believes that dreams come true. Madeline, welcome to the show.
Hello, Peter. It's great to talk to you.
Thank you. It's so nice to have you on the show. Madeline, because the connections are so irregular this evening, I should ask you right off the bat, can you hear me okay?
I can hear you pretty well.
Wonderful. If that changes at all, Madeline, please just speak up and let us know. The studio has lots of bells and whistles and dials and knobs, and they can normally fix that right up.
Sure thing.
Okay, great. I'm also using a landline telephone, so it's a little strange. Madeline, you know, the people who have come to us from Dream Spinner Press have been just amazing guests and so unexpected. I'm so glad that you could join us this evening. And Madeline, tell us about your relationship with Dream Spinner and how you started out with them.
It's been a wonderful relationship with Dream Spinner. I couldn't ask for a better introduction to professional publishing. I found out about the press through a friend. You know, it's always who you know, right?
Yeah.
Rhianne Ale, she's another one of their authors, and she got in when the press was just starting out, and then contacted some of her friends and said, hey, you know, go ahead and submit. You never know what'll happen. And she said she believed in us. And so that was me. And you talked to Ariel a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
And a few other ladies. And so, you know, we kind of bit the bullet and did it and submitted. And it's been a wild ride ever since.
Madeline, am I pronouncing it correctly, by the way? Is it Madeline Urban?
Madeline.
Madeline, thank you. I wasn't quite sure. I have a neighbor whose name is Madeline, and I always call her, you know, sometimes I may slip because I've known her for so many years. Well, Madeline, certainly in the very beginning, if you've been writing since you could hold a crayon, you didn't begin by writing gay erotica or gay fiction. Tell us about your publishing past and your writing experiences. You must have started very young.
I did. My mom has told me the stories of me, you know, scrawling words across a page instead of drawing pictures. I remember tapping out stories on an old manual typewriter.
Yes.
And, you know, I couldn't even have been 6 or 7. And I don't think any of those exist anymore, but my mom might have one tucked away somewhere. That'd be pretty scary. And it just kind of, I kept dabbling with it from there. I've always been a voracious reader, and, you know, it's kind of that syndrome. You fall in love with something, and you want to read more, and there isn't more, so you have to create it yourself. And
an interesting story.
Know,
did you have a literary family? Did your mother write? Were there other folks in the family? For instance, I find that a lot of writers come from musical families.
Not particularly, just voracious readers. We all read huge amounts, and we're always got a book, a novel or something open. You know, my parents read to me from, you know, in the womb. And, you know, love of the written word has always been major in my family.
I see. And this all took place in Kentucky. You were born in Kentucky?
I was actually born in Indiana, but I've lived in Kentucky since I was 3. So Kentucky's home, yeah.
I see. Well, Madeline, you no doubt had experiences in school writing for various school publications and that sort of thing. Did you in fact do that? And what sort of articles did you write, if you did?
I started out in middle school with newspapers, you know, student newspapers, essay contests. I was published in the daily newspaper in the city. I entered a writing contest, and that kind of, you know, whetted my appetite for writing for public consumption. And then it went on from there. You know, in high school, you had a newspaper. We had a literary magazine. We had a newspaper. I was a competition writer.
Wow.
And it just kept going from there. I mean, I got good at it. You know, you practice something long enough,
wow,
and you get good at it.
What is a competition writer, if I may ask? That sounds terribly, terribly intense.
Academic teams, you know, high schools and middle schools will have academic teams, and they'll do local and regional competitions. And I actually went to state competition writing in the English composition category twice. So
I see.
Well, if you're good at writing, the schools will start you out in it and keep you doing it.
I see.
As long as
were
you're
you
willing.
Also active in the theater, too, when you were in school, or school plays, that
yeah.
sort of
Yeah, school plays. I think the writing in the theater has always appealed to me because of, you know, imagination. My mother especially was always very supportive and encouraged me to, you know, be as imaginative as I could be and to write my little stories and to tell little stories. And we watched all kinds of sci-fi and fantasy movies because, you know, that's about as imaginative as you can get. And that just translated into theater, and I stuck with theater from high school through college and a little bit after before I finally moved on.
Wow. One wonders, have you written other genres other than surely you've written, or have you written, like a romance novel that you would normally see it in the grocery store, the more commonly heterosexual available? Is that, or did you, when you began writing this sort of fiction, did you start with the gay genre?
When I first started writing, I did write, you know, the more standard heterosexual pairing, mostly things that echoed, you know, relationships you'd see in TV shows or movies that I liked. But that was just more dabbling. It wasn't anything that I really ever did anything with. And I pretty well quickly converted over to the gay relationship just because I saw it as another, you know, real form of love there that you can see between two people, and I believe in that, and, you know, a lot of people may not, but I do, so it's something that means a lot to me.
Well, what would you say your influences were? One wonders if there's a short story about Brokeback Mountain. It was only 49 pages long. what a hit it turned out to be. What were your influences to begin this? Or did you read some of the gay erotica and say, wow, that's something I'd like to try?
I had some really good friends in college who were gay couples, and which, you know, really helped me see that, you know, in a very positive light, in a very good light. And when I moved on and started reading online, reading stories, original fiction, fan fiction, anything that I could find that related to something I was interested in, then I started reading it, you know, and you see a lot of bad fiction, and you see some good fiction, and you see, you know, a little less of really good fiction. And the more of the really good stuff that you read, the more you want to read. So when I started seeing that there is a big percentage of good writing in this genre that's yet to be discovered, I wanted to be a part of that.
Well, Madeline, I'm wondering about the reaction that your readers have to the fact that you are female. And do they comment on that? And if they do, how do you handle that?
Most all of my friends are female. The other co-writers that I know, and so we're all very supportive. I do have some male acquaintances and friends who think it's just great. I also have a few who are kind of like, well, I don't really know how you know what you're talking about, but okay. I really haven't met anyone who is critical to my faith. So I guess I'm lucky in that way. I'm sure I'd be able to handle it if I did, but for the most part, you know, a couple of times I've seen reviews. There's a review up on Amazon.com for my book, Caught Running, that I co-wrote with Abigail Rue. The comment, you know, was positive, and they praised us, the writer did, and basically said, I don't know how these two women know what this is like, but they got it spot on, and it's really great, and you need to read it. And so Abigail and I were just thrilled by that.
Well, one wonders, with the success of Annie, I believe it's pronounced Perlow's Brokeback Mountain, that short story, and obviously Erica's success and your success also, what is your insight into the uncanny understanding of relationships, male-to-male relationships, that you think women have? Can you help to explain to us these insights? Because obviously they're very deep and very accurate.
Yes. I think I relate to it more so than some people because I happen to be quite a bit of an introvert. And when it comes to relationships and emotions, I think the bigger part of the male relationship of the male population are more introverted, at least in that part of their lives. And so I can kind of connect to that to know, you know, it's hard to say things. It's hard to be emotional. It's hard to let things show. And when you kind of see that, you know, a lot of guys will keep that inside. You know, you can relate to that as a character as well. And that's not to say all men are like that, but, you know, you kind of think, you know, it's the male stereotype. We've seen all that, you know, big tough guy, you know, maybe a chip on his shoulder, handsome, good looking, but has had terrible luck at relationships. And so doesn't want to talk about, you know, love or sex or anything like that unless he's out with his buddies. And I think people understand that, but then they don't quite make that jump to the fact that, you know, even if they're stereotypes, these guys have feelings too. And I think that's where women kind of play into that, maybe figuring that they understand it a little better.
That's well put. I think, in fact, women do have a better handle on the language of love and intimacy than men do, and of course that includes gay men. Certainly gay men are brought up in the same culture as every other man, so the things that you learn in childhood are things that that gay kids learn too, which are not things about expressing yourself emotionally and connecting in that way. In fact, I think that women certainly could teach us a few things.
Some women are willing to do so. I mean, you know, matchmakers, I know quite a few. And there's a lady that I know, her name is Alex, and she's been published by Dream Center Press, and she is so open about love and relationships and sexuality. And even a friend of hers named Julianne, who's just published a book about having more relationships in your life and being more open both as a man and a woman. And I just admire that so much, the people who can reach out to others. And me, not necessarily so, especially not, you know, person to person. And I kind of put that into my writing instead.
I see. Well, certainly this is all new to me. You could have knocked me over with a feather a few weeks ago when I first spoke with Ariel and then John, because, you know, frankly, I think it's wonderful. In fact, I was delighted to see, I happen to be a subscriber to Netflix, and I was delighted to see a huge LGBT section on Netflix, which they should pay me because, yeah, I mentioned Netflix a lot on this show. There's a huge LGBT section, and none of it, not a bit of it, is pornographic. It's about relationships and situations and you know, all the things that that LGBT folks go to. And I went through that section with much happiness, and because the fact that it wasn't, you know, pure pornography. It talked about you know, which is kind of what I think LGBT folks have come to expect. Over the years, the literature has always just been plain pornography. How long has gay romances, how long has this existed? I'm really curious about this.
I'm sure it's always been out there in some form. I mean, you could go back to Anais Nin and the Little Birds. She was a writer and wrote erotic fiction and had both heterosexual and homosexual relationships in her story. I think a lot of the exposure, at least from my background and people that I know, comes from, you know, the much debated, sometimes hated, and a lot of times loved fan fiction. Because, you know, people just connect to those characters so well because they know them. And so they see that as a way to find out about how it works. And there's always going to be some aspect, you know, some bit of it, some percentage, that's going to be just sex, you know, whether it's up to the level of pornography. It always depends on what your definition of that is.
I completely agree.
Obviously, or if it would you would consider it erotica, or if you would consider it kinky, I don't know. But then there's also a big percentage of who's romance. I mean, okay, how big a percentage of women are romantic, right? Either outwardly or at heart, and a lot of men are too. Romance is a feel good thing. It's happy. It makes you smile, and you know, a lot of people. I know I do. I need that. To know that there are happy endings and to know that there are people out there who enjoy life just as much as I might. And to see that, you know, everybody loves a feel-good movie. Same thing as a book.
Yeah.
So,
not
I think that's probably where it came from.
One wonders about the parallels between the heterosexual romance novels and some of the books that you've written. How would you compare the erotic content? Is it about the same in either genre, or does it tend to be more intense in the gay novels? Or one wonders how all that figures in, but it just mm-hmm. from the comparison.
If you'd asked me that 20 years ago, I'd say that there was a huge difference for the same reason as what you had just mentioned. That, you know, a lot of the gay and lesbian population, you know, what they could find bordered more on porn. I have seen in publishing myself, being a sci-fi and fantasy fan, a lot more erotica has been present and accepted, and especially, you know, gay erotica in sci-fi and fantasy for decades. And on bestseller shelves now, there are just as many novels with heterosexual couples or homosexual couples or trios or even more, you know, especially in the wildly popular now, you know, supernatural type fiction, whether it's vampires or magicians or wizards or demon hunters. A lot of that's real popular right now on, you know, even the bestseller list. The past 10 years especially, I've seen more mainstream novels getting more erotic. And I think that if people are kind of seeing that it can succeed out in the main marketplace, and it doesn't matter whether it's going to be gay or not.
Well, Madeline, I have to laugh at myself. Living in the deep south on a dirt road, I really should get out more often. Madeline, what was the first novel, or was it a short story? What was the first that you wrote?
That I wrote ever?
For this genre, for the gay romance.
This genre. Oh my gosh. I think it was a Star Trek story, actually. That I wrote was the first thing that I wrote as a male male pairing.
I'll be darned.
That was years ago.
Wow.
We're probably talking 15 years ago now.
Wow, was it published? Well, we have some real Star Trek fans in the chat room.
No, it's not published, and it's not even fan published. There is a huge fan publishing world out there, especially in Star Trek. But no, I never published any of that stuff.
I see. And was the first novel length that you wrote in gay romances, was that For Dream Spinner, and what was it?
My first novel length piece, yes, it was For Dream Spinner, and would be that's Caught Running that I wrote with Abigail. It's the first full novel. I've written lots of books. My first book just had my name and novellas in it. I can't necessarily be a lot of that. To me, you know, 75,000 or 80,000 words or more, that's a lot. And I need a co-author to help keep me motivated when I'm doing that. I tend more toward short version fiction.
I see. I heard most of that. We had a little bit of a connectivity issue there for just a second. Tell us about Abigail. And apparently, you've mentioned her several times in your profile and on your blog. How did you come to meet Abigail? And does she write with you often?
I met Abigail online through fan fiction, actually, and through movie fandom, just watching the same kind of movies and. We both were writers at the time, just casually, and grew to know each other over a couple of years, I guess, and met up at one point with some other friends and just kind of hit it off. And one day we were both kind of sitting around bored chatting online and said, well, you know, why don't we try writing something? It started that easy. I mean, it really did. It was just like, well, let's try writing something. You know, our muses are kind of quiet right now. Let's try to jumpstart something and see what happens. And it's really kind of gone from there. You know, I guess we've been writing together now for at least a couple of years.
I see. I see. And was Caught Running your first submission to Dream Spinner?
Abigail and I together, yes.
I see.
And we were... I mean, I was thrilled when it was picked up to be published. So, and I know Abigail was too. Abigail is a much more prolific writer than I am. And long format, she's published another big novel with Dream Spinner. But she and I continue to write together. We've also written another book that Dream Spinner published that had two romance novellas in it. And, we just received a contract to sign for a third novel, so we're really excited.
Wow. Now then, tell us about Caught Running. What is the gist of the story? It looks like a football player on the cover.
The baseball player.
Oh, baseball. Okay.
Yeah. the background of this is, yet again, Abigail and I are sitting there going, ho-hum, let's twiddle our thumbs and, hey, let's try to write something. And we're just kind of chatting about different ideas. And at the time, she is a huge baseball fan. I mean, huge. You can't get to be a bigger baseball fan than Abigail. And we both had backgrounds working in school,
yeah,
teaching, and we came up with this idea about two teachers, and then we looked at our own backgrounds, and she came from the background of the athlete, the jock, you might call him, you know, your stereotypical jock. She felt she had the background to do that, and I definitely had the background for the academic student, because I sure as heck was a geek in school, and it just kind of built from there. So it's two teachers. It's a academic teacher, a science teacher, and a baseball coach.
Oh, my God. So is there a love triangle that develops between them?
Is there a what? I'm sorry?
A love triangle?
No, it's just two characters. So it's the two characters knew each other. They were in high school together. And knew each other then just vaguely. And then, you know, 10 years later, they're both teaching at the same school and get thrown together because the science teacher is assigned to work as an assistant coach on the baseball team. And it's nothing really overdone. I mean, there's not some huge twisty plot to it. It's just two people who get put together through, you know, very regular circumstances, and they happen to change each other's lives.
I see. Madeline, do most of your books have happy endings, or are you not a happy ending kind of writer?
I've laughed about this because I got a piece of feedback from a reviewer. Or it was a reviewer of one of my stories and said that, you know, Madeline Odin is my happy ending queen. And I was just bowled over because I don't think of myself as a happy ending writer. I think of myself as more pragmatic. And, but then I started looking at what I've published, and I guess, yeah, you probably could say I am a happy ending writer because pretty much everything I've published does have a happy ending. I mean, I believe in that, and I think it's great. And I guess it's all a matter of, you know, if I'm happy with it and the readers are happy with it, you know, I'm good with happy endings. So it's just odd to me.
Yeah, I'm certainly not advocating that you change. I think in the world that we live in today is so disappointed and heartbreaking, I think that happy endings are probably a good thing. Madeline, do you get a lot of mail from women who read your book?
I get a little bit. I don't really get a whole lot. You know, maybe 5 or 10 a month feedback. A few come through the Dream Center Press website, and I do get some comments on my blog more than I get comments through email. My blog is madelineurban.livejournal.com, and I post there about my books and about what I'm working on and when something's gone up for sale, and it's pretty low traffic. But I guess I do get some good feedback, and then we get reviewer comments and postings on, like, Amazon or Barnes & Noble where readers leave feedback.
I see. By the way, we are posting links to your sites, MadelineUrban at .livejournal.com in the chat room, and also a longer link for Dream Center. But for those who are not on the web and are not in the chat room, it's MadelineUrban.livejournal.com. That's MadeLeine Urban, URBAN rather, .livejournal.com. What is your favorite book that you've written?
My favorite book that I've written. My book would, I think of mine as stories because I have both novels and short stories. And I would have to say the book would be my Far From Home, my sci-fi book that has 3 stories in it. And of those 3 stories, Following the Sun is probably my absolute favorite thing I've ever published.
I see. So I'm looking at the cover of Far From Home, and so there are 3 stories. It's a 3-part episode in one book. Is that three episodes? Is that the way it works?
They're actually 3 standalone stories. They're not related.
I see.
Yeah.
I see. But they're all on from the science fiction side of the fence?
Yes, they are. The first story, Enhanced, is about beings who are bioengineered in the future and how it goes wrong, and sort of how a romance catches up in the action. It's very action oriented. You know, the relationship is in there. And then the second story, Close Encounter, is your run of the mill, run into the aliens who want to kill you kind of story. During a war, you know, it's a tried and true story concept in sci-fi. And then the third one is it's actually sort of a time travel fix, kind of. A couple of guys crash land on a planet, crash land from space, and find themselves transported back to a era of a tribe that's kind of modeled on, like, you know, the ancient Aztecs or Mayans, more like the Mayans. And, you know, they have to fit in. They don't know how they're going to get back, if they ever get back, so they basically start a new life. And it goes from there. I guess I don't think, you know, you asked about the happy ending. I don't necessarily think about that with a lot of my stories, because there's a lot of time there's another element there in the story, whether it's, you know, the aliens are going to kill us, or, you know, we're far from home and we don't know if we're ever going to get back.
Well, yeah, that does be more evident, more pressing. There are more pressing issues there.
Yeah, but then it's very important to me that the relationship is well developed in these stories, and you know, how it develops based on the rest of the plot. You know, you're not just throwing in and saying, oh, these two people get together and they're going to have sex and they're going to run away from the aliens and that's it. No, for me, it doesn't work that way. So there's always going to be more to it than that if I'm writing it.
That sounds wonderful. In fact, Far From Home is the name of that. It sounds like something I ought to get a copy of and read. I bet I would enjoy it, being a science fiction fan.
Oh, wonderful. The other one, you know, several of my works are along those lines, but you might also look at the Desire Beyond Death anthology by Dream Center Press, and my short story in it, Bittersweet, is sort of supernatural. All of them in that book have supernatural elements to them, and so it's kind of got a fantasy angle to it.
Well, Madam, what are you working on, a new project, or is what are you working on now for Dream Spinner?
I actually just finished. I mean, just talking like a week, 2 weeks ago, finished submitting a novel to Dream Spinner with Abigail that I just mentioned, and that was months of work. And so right now I'm actually taking a breather. Imagine that. but we've already got ideas. The book that we just submitted, Cut and Run, is more like my writing. There's a plot and action, and the relationship is in their building as well, and I think it's going to be a big hit. And Abigail and I love it so much, and the characters came so alive for us that we're already sketching out the idea for a sequel to it, and we're hoping that it does well enough that we can sell it too. So
wonderful. What have you chosen a title for the new book at this point, or is that still up in the air?
The title is going to be Cut and Run. I'm going to cut your losses and run. This is just Cut and Run. It is it's two FBI agents who are put on a case to catch a serial killer. And like I say, it's going to be different for Abigail and I, because the two books that we've put out so far have been, you know, your pretty traditional romances. This one's got quite a kind of a thriller suspense angle to it, and I think it's probably the best thing we've written yet.
I see. There's it looks to me as if you have published an awful lot of material with Dream Spinner. I'm looking at one called Know When to Hold 'Em. Is that also a collection of short stories?
Yes. Dream Spinner put out some open calls for submissions, and I submitted to several different ones, and that's how I got lucky enough to be submitted to be published so many times. Knowing the whole of them was like Westerns and Riverboat Gamblers and Cowboys.
It does look like a Western, judging from the cover. There's the pistol on the table and with a deck of cards and a candle. It certainly has that
look. Yeah, and my story, actually, when I first submitted it, I didn't know if it would fit really well, but I was assured that it did. The story that I published in that anthology is called Serengeti, and it was about African bush rangers. who live out there in the savannah and keep track of things that are going in the park, and legal trappers for zoos, and that's all just a very basic background that you get through the story, but it's very relationship focused. And but it's short. It's a very short story compared to a lot of the others, compared to a lot of mine. But I've been told that it's a very powerful story from the way that it's told. It's told in a first-person aspect from another character watching the main relationship go on. And
Madeline, I've asked the other guests this question, and so to be fair, I have to ask it of you, too. What does your partner think of what you do?
When I started my first story, he was more excited than I was. My husband was just jumping up and down thrilled when I told my first story and just was ecstatic. I mean, he was more excited than I was. I was sitting there going, oh, okay, this is pretty neat. And he's like, woo, I'm taking you out to dinner. We're going to celebrate. and he's still very excited. I mean, when I got my first royalty check, he made a copy and wanted to frame it for me. So, that's very motivating.
Go ahead.
Yeah, he doesn't read my stuff, but he's very, well, okay, he says he's listening here as I talk, and he said he's read very teeny, but a bit of it. It's not his thing, and he's read the sci-fi stuff. It's not his thing, and I'm fine with that, but he is very supportive of it. And sometimes I'll ask ideas about, do you think this would work? And he'd be like, oh, yeah, or no, don't even do it.
I see. That was exactly where I was headed. I was wondering if you sometimes run a couple of paragraphs past him or ideas, if he sort of helps you on the sidelines like that.
Yes, he does. He does. He helps me out. I'll throw out a situation and say, do you think this would work? Abigail and I were riding a car chase, and we had worked on it so much I just could not see it in my head anymore. And so I asked him to look over a piece of it, and he pointed out a few things that, wouldn't be scientifically possible. So we could fix those, because we'd been working on it for so long, we had it all messed up. But yes, he does. He helps me out with that, and it's a big help because, two heads are better than one when it comes to background ideas and information. If you're constructing a character's career or trying to set up a situation of some kind.
Well, Madeline, have you and Abigail thought about writing screenplays?
No. No, actually, not that I know. She may have thought about it. I haven't. I don't know that I have those ambitions. I guess that would be great if somebody contacted me about it, but I hadn't thought about that at all.
Well, certainly with the success of Brokeback Mountain, which was only 49 pages long, I think that's been demonstrated this huge potential there.
Yeah, that's true. I actually got some feedback from a few people comparing my story, Serengeti, that's in the No When to Hold 'Em anthology, to Brokeback Mountain. And to be honest, at the time, I was horrified, not because of the comparison, but because I would never put myself in the same league as Annie Polu. And that was just, I guess I was flattered that they were going at it more from the, because it's a very short format, and it's a straightforward, this is what happens, and similar, out in the wild kind of setup. I guess that's where they got those comparisons. But I don't know. When I write my books, when I write with Abigail or if I write with Rianne, I'm a very visual writer. I see everything in my head just as if it were a movie. And then I have to take that and translate it into words and set sound to it. And sometimes it's very difficult to you know, if you were trying to watch a movie and describe it to somebody who couldn't see it, that's basically what I do when I write.
I don't know if I could do it the other way. it sounds like the visual aspect would lead you straight into the movie theater at some point. It certainly wouldn't surprise me. Over at livejournal.com, you mentioned Cunning Weaver. Is that a person? Is that a pseudonym of yours?
That is from a quote by Sappho, the ancient female lesbian poet, that love is a cunning weaver. And I found that years and years ago, and it's always been in the back of my mind. And let's see, I'm looking for the exact phrase. Okay. Love is a cunning weaver of fantasies and fables. And since my favorite thing to read and to imagine is a fantasy, and you know, romance is just as much that as it is a reality. So I saw it as very representative of what I'm trying to do. You know, when you write a story, you're weaving it all together. So that's where that came from, Cunning Weaver. I'm hoping to aspire to that.
It's a wonderful quote. I had seen that in relation to Sappho, but I was wondering if perhaps it could also be a writer's name, and I was just trying to figure that out when I saw that on the site. Are you going to be doing audiobooks? Are any of these available as an audiobook?
They are not. At this time, I've talked with Elizabeth, the publisher at Dream Center. She's looked into the possibility of audiobooks, and it's kind of one of those work in possible progress thing, you know, that we'd like to try. I've actually done a little bit of research on it, talking with some other authors from other presses about their audiobooks and if they're popular and if they sell, how they produce them. You know, my first question is, do you have a man read them or do you have a woman read them? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which would you
listen to if you're reading a story that man relationship? Are you going to be more into it if you hear about it in a man's voice or if you hear about it in a woman's voice?
That would depend on the scene in my mind.
Yeah, yeah, depending on the scene. That's true too. I hadn't thought about that. I've never been a big audiobook listener. I've only listened to maybe 10 in my whole life, and all those happen to be read by females. So, but I do have to admit that they were your more standard romance novels. So, you know, the mainstream type. So, I don't know. I think it would be interesting, and I think it would be popular considering how popular iPods are. You know, MP3 players. I could see that it would be a market for it.
Yes, I can see that. I can see that, too. I completely agree with you. What we ought to do is get ourselves a copy of Brokeback Mountain and see what gender reads that. And we should probably use that as an example.
Yeah, we could. We could look at that on Amazon.com, I'm sure.
Yeah. I'm looking at the book cover called Man of Mystery. Now, but it doesn't have your name on it, yet it was on your page. I'm trying to figure that out.
I'd have to look at that. Man of Mystery isn't a published hardback, you know, hard copy book. It is it was a test by Dream Center of publishing an ebook only.
I see, and my mistake also, as you pointed, it does have your name on it. That's my mistake.
Yeah, at the bottom of the cover, I think. I haven't looked at that one in a while. But it was a story that I had that I thought was pretty good, and I sent it as a submission for an anthology. Well, it was way too long. It's about 70-something pages.
Well, it looks to me that looking at the man on the cover, it looks as if he's dressed in, like, old English clothes, or it looks like a misty scene from Ireland. What is the book about?
The book is about a young husband who is kind of a house husband, hasn't had a lot of aspirations in his life, and the way I wrote it was that he's not in a good marriage. He is sort of an unspoken abusive relationship, emotionally abusive. It's something that I feel strong about is spouse abuse, and I firmly believe, and a lot of people, you know, refuse to recognize that spouse abuse can take more forms than physical abuse. Emotional abuse, mental abuse is just as bad, if not worse. And that was where the basic idea came from. He's living in this situation and has an argument and runs off away from his wife and gets hit by a car and wakes up not knowing who he is for real. He thinks he is a character out of a book, The Man of Mystery. That's where the title comes from. He loves to read these sort of maybe James Bond-ish Playboy-type action adventures as a way to get away from his real life. He wakes up thinking he is this man of mystery.
Sure.
And it just kind of goes from there as he mixes up his imagined life with his real life. But then, you know, at the end, it goes back to the beginning subject, which is, you know, what he was having to live with that drove him to do this. When I first wrote the novel, short story, that wasn't my main plan. My main plan was, ooh, it would be neat for him to at the end have amnesia and think he's a character of a book. And then some readers actually were reading it and pointed that out and said, you know, this is great because, you know, it's not the main storyline, but the underlying point of this was that, you know, through this adventure that he goes on, he finds it within himself to be able to stand up and get away from that situation and get out of the abusive situation.
Well, Madeline, I have to say that there would probably be a long line of men who would love to be a character in one of your books.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So what a wonderful, wonderful way to do that, to be it. Well, you know, that just makes me want to read the story because I can't ask you how it ends. That wouldn't be fair. So I have to read the story. Rana, tell us again how one can find your books. Are they available any brick and mortar? Are they available as downloads via a PDF? And if so, where? Or they're little things these days. I'm supposed to be really up on technology, but some things I'm not, like these little portable books. What's up with that? Are you available there?
Okay. Well, on my blog, first of all, at the top of the page, if people want to reference there, I have some links to several sources where you can get the books. Of course, Dream Spinner Press, dreamspinnerpress.com. You can order the books in hard copy. If you like the hard copy, you can order them as PDF. They've got several different formats of PDF, just your standard PDF, or if you want to read it on like a Palm Pilot or a Mobi book. I think they're doing 3 or 4 different formats now. It's kind of neat. Our books are available for order online through Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. I think Borders as well, where you can order the hard copy. We're also available through All Romance eBooks, which is just eBooks, thousands and thousands and thousands of them. And I spend far too much time on that website myself looking for things to read. And I think there's links to pretty much everything from my blog, so if you wanted to go there and look at them. I also have a handful of short stories that are available and PDF only through Dream Center's if you just want to read something short and entertaining. So there's lots of different ways, you know, although it's pretty much all online. I don't know that any of the bigger stores, Barnes & Noble or Borders, are carrying hard copies unless the manager or the distributor knows us for some reason to put us in the stores. I suppose it could happen, but I haven't seen any that have happened that way. That would be awfully exciting, though.
Natalie, as I've mentioned, you may have heard me say that we have a chat room. There's a question from one of the chatters. He is asking if you've ever been to WISCON, WISCON, in Madison, Wisconsin, and apparently it's a feminist science fiction convention.
No, I haven't. That's really neat. I've been attending science fiction and fantasy conventions for 20 years, but I haven't been up to Wisconsin. No, that's a great idea. I'll have to look that one up.
Yeah, I don't think it's too far from your neck of the woods. What is it, one or two states away? Are you still in Kentucky?
I'm sorry?
Are you still in Kentucky? I wasn't sure if you still live there.
Yes, I am in Kentucky.
Yeah.
I would guess Madison's probably a good 12 hours, but that's not too bad, I guess. It might be less than that. For a convention, I've gone farther. So.
Yeah, exactly. Well, he's probably at WISCON, WISCON, in Madison, Wisconsin.
Okay.
It's a feminist science fiction conference or convention. I imagine that would be very interesting.
I've
wandered all over the map asking you questions, but I don't want to close out without just opening the floor to you. Perhaps we haven't talked about something that was burning in your heart that you wanted to say to us, or just anything that you'd like to say.
If you want to write, just do it for yourself. I've learned, especially in the last year, that if you write with the goal to be published and that's the only goal that you have, you're not going to get near as much satisfaction out of it as if you write because you want to, because you feel something for it. For me, getting published is a wonderful thing. It's great. I can get lots of recognition, and I'm making some money, and get to see my books bound and have them in my hand. But the satisfaction of knowing that I did it and completed it and I'm happy with it, it means more to me personally. So I'd say if you want to try it, you got to try it and keep at it, and don't get discouraged.
Well, I have to say to you, Madeline, and I mean this toward the other writers who have been on from Dreamspinner also, what a wonderful group of people you have been, and what wonderful guests you have been, and you've certainly opened my eyes. One would have never thought that women would even occur to write stories like this. So, and thank you for doing it. I think that's a remarkable thing, regardless of what some may say.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to have all of us on. I think it's remarkable what you're doing as well with your broadcast.
Well, thank you. Thank you. The show is near and dear to my heart, and I very much appreciated it. And thank you so much for being with us.
Sure. Have a great night.
Thank you. Good evening to you. And, folks, that was Madeline Urban, the third in our series of authors from Dreamspinner Press, who write gay romantic fiction / erotica. And she's the second female writer. We had a male writer last week. And the people that I meet on this show never ceases to amaze me, the depth and the breadth and the heights and the width of the variations in what people do. That certainly has been an eye-opener for me in doing this show. We're about to go to a top-of-the-hour break, and I'm going to give you a short paragraph just before we do, today being the 63rd anniversary of what happened in Hiroshima. course, the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki was a criminal act on an epic scale, and it was premeditated mass murder, and it unleashed a weapon of, by its very nature, criminality. Now, I say this because the United States Strategic Bombing Survey of 1946 said that many people said that the bomb saved lives, but the United States Strategic Bombing Survey of 1946 said even without the atomic bombing attacks, air supremacy over Japan could have exerted sufficient pressure to bring about unconditional surrender and completely eliminate the need for invasion. This is based on detailed investigation of all the facts and supported by the testimony of surviving Japanese leaders. And it was the survey's opinion that Japan would have surrendered even if the atomic bombs had never been dropped, and even if Russia had not entered the war, and even if no invasion had been planned. Regardless of how you feel about Hiroshima, we'll go to break with a wonderful Hot Tracks remix called Hiroshima by Sandra. Roll it back.
Words to Hiroshima, let the sky explode.
riding across America on a horse named Strictly Confidential, a man who knows his way around a pair of chaps. Here's your host, Peter Godbold.
Yes, indeed, I am back for hour two of Strictly Confidential. This is Peter Godbold, and this is Strictly Confidential. The toll-free line is 877, the number 4, head-on. That translates into 877-443-2366, unlimited long distance. Well, you could use that. That's area code 304-658-3333. That's 304-658-3333. Email arrives normally to Peter at headonradionetwork.com. However, for this evening only, because of the internet issues we're having, I need to use web-based mail. So this evening, use pgodbold@yahoo.com for this evening only. And by the way, I do try to check the mail during the breaks. And just in the period of time that Madeline was on the show with us, the absolute filth that filled up in the Yahoo mailbox just amazes me. I'm talking about graphic sexual, you know, it's gone way beyond Viagra. You know, it's almost S&M. Just looking at your email on Yahoo, I use it as a throwaway account. You know, when I fill out anything on the web that requires an email address, I use yahoo.com because that's, you know, that's going to end up in everybody's hands anyway if you fill out anything on the web. So anyway, we're talking about erotica and pornography with Madeline, and I just wanted to tell you that I have just seen pornography, and it was in my inbox at yahoo.com. Again, the program this evening is highly irregular because of the internet speed issues that we've had here since last Sunday. I'm barely faster than dial-up. So the standard headphones, microphone, mixer, and limiter and all that stuff is just not possible this evening. I have to tell you, it is very, very strange holding a telephone to my ear and doing a show. I am so accustomed to having my knobs and my volume controls and my mute buttons right at hand's reach, that this is exceedingly weird. But nonetheless, we have a wonderful guest this evening, and certainly we do the show any way we can possibly do it. That will be the case tomorrow, too. I certainly hope the Internet is prepared by tomorrow. Fat chance. By the way, the company is called Embark, E-M-B-A-R-Q, the worst phone company in existence in the United States. Tomorrow evening's guest is Amuka. She's also known as Sheila Brody. Amuka comes to us by way of our executive director of music and talent booking, Sister Glenn Rivera. She is a club diva, to be sure. If you don't know the name Amuka, just stop by YouTube and do a search on Amuka, A-M-U-K-A, and you will find out a whole lot about Amuka there on YouTube. Many of her videos are there. Also let you know that next Thursday, another guest from Mr. Glenn Rivera is Lucy Neal. And Lucy was part of the From Here to Eternity project by George Gilmore, and also appeared with Donna Summer on her Once Upon a Time LP. And she has incredible stories to tell. Looking at a surprise guest that I dare not mention. It's not confirmed yet, but this will be a guest that will make me very, very nervous as a music guest on the 28th. We're looking forward to seeing if that works out and comes through. Let's see here. Phone cocked between my shoulder. Yes, if only the United States, a wonderful place it would be. You know, over in Europe and more than one country in Europe, there are laws against hate speech. Even though the Christian fundamentalists screamed and yelled and said that it interfered with their religious freedom, there are laws against hate speech and speeches that incite to riot. Brings to mind the Hannitys and the Limbaughs and the O'Reillys. It brings to mind the man that shot the people at the Unitarian Church in Knoxville the other day, who was incited to do that by the broadcast media in this country, whom we turn our head away. We never criticize them. And that's probably the largest festering sore on this continent is the media. And
what passes for news is pure hate speech. It's cheap, and it's divisive, and it's hurtful. But it's not that way in Belfast. See a newspaper ad that was placed in the Belfast newsletter ahead of the city's Gay Pride event is being investigated by the Advertising Standards Authority. If we only had something of that nature here, that the Hannity shows could be investigated, etc. It was a 540-word advertisement. It was taken out by the Free Presbyterian Church. The Free Presbyterian Church in Belfast ran a ad, 540 words in length, that described gay people just prior to the Pride event as being perverts and was highly critical of the parade. The Advertising Standards Authority, the ASA, told Pink News that the decision about whether it breached the code will be made in the next few days. It stated that the gay community desires to be known for a perverted form of sexuality, and the church says that it will not be intimidated into silence. The church says the act of sodomy is grave, and it is an offense to every Bible believer who accepts the pure message of God's precious word. In the mind of God, homosexuality is an abomination, according to their ad. The advertisement was printed in the newsletter on August 1st, the day before the Belfast Pride. The ad went on to say, "This parade is not a welcome addition to our city, neither is it positive of a profitable lifestyle, flaunting a form of sexuality that generations of men and women have righteously resisted. By God's grace, they will continue to resist." Here again we have the old standard resist who you are argument. Apparently for some people you can resist it who are gay or lesbian. Apparently some do resist it. For others who are exclusively left or right-handed, you'll bear with that. There is no resistance possible, but here again, these are issues we've covered hundreds of times. The Free Presbyterian Church was founded 56 years ago. Oh, and I did laugh out loud when I first read it. You know, the great Christian writings and teachings that have gone on for 1,000 years for the library shelves with huge volumes of thought and guidance. But the Free Presbyterian Church founded 56 years ago by the former First Minister of Northern Ireland, and it mounts a yearly counter-protest to the Belfast Pride. It sounds like a kinder, gentler, perhaps milder form of Fred Felt. Last year, a politician resigned as the leader of the church after coming under pressure from its members over gay rights issues. The fundamentalist Christian sect were outraged, as well as other members of the Democratic Unionist Party, that they ignored their objections to government financial support for the Pride marches, which they call celebrations of sodomy. And what a rich heritage. After all, they've been there for 56 years. Can you imagine that? More than 4,000 people turned out despite poor weather conditions. Thousands more watched the parade. Despite the 56-year-old, highly traditional, long-time existing Presbyterian Church in Belfast. Forgot to tell you that at the bottom of the hour, the DJ across the street this evening is Mr. Larry Sanders over at MorningstarMelody.com. We'll be running that section in just a few minutes toward the bottom of the hour. A couple more comments in the article I just covered with you that they're saying that there can be no viler act apart from homosexuality, sodomy, and child abuse. Just thought you'd like to know. There is a story in Sweden regarding mandatory sterilization of trans bodies meaning the body of anyone who is transgendered or transsexual anyway. The legislation would make it mandatory, I tell you, to remove the testicles and ovaries of each case as sex reassignment surgery. And if the course amounts to forced sterilization, to, of course, eliminate the embarrassing possibility, like we endured the United States of the trans man, Thomas Beatty, who had a child who was pregnant. Now, this is not the first time that it's been suggested that certain people's bodies or certain bodies undergo castration. It is well documented. Eugenics programs in North America have castrated those who are considered to be mentally deficient. That includes LGBTs in the mentally deficient category, Native American women, black women. These castrations and sterilizations took place without consent. Now, what all these bodies have in common is that they are marginalized bodies. Now, the eugenics folks promote racial and genetic purity without acknowledging that the faults that they are critical of stem from a very direct result of the systematic social discrimination against the targeted bodies in question. So in the case of someone identifying as trans, eliminating their ability to reproduce will not reduce the amount of trans people who identify themselves as trans in society. Trans people are born to regular old everyday family, and the fact is looked, it's overlooked, and it's just plain fear. You cannot raise someone to be gay. You cannot raise someone to be trans. It's either in their identity or it is not in their identity. It is naturally occurring like any number of other variants in the rainbow. The legislation that's being talked about in Sweden amounts to nothing more than trans hate. I wonder why we hate the trans people so much. Assume that one group of people has the right to control the biology and reproduction of another is way, way past arrogance. Way past arrogance. The fact that this even needs to be brought up in the 21st century is a shame. It's very distressing that this is still being talked about. And what if trans people were to suggest that heterosexuals should be castrated because they were somehow abnormal? Well, it'd be reduced to laughter. You know, a group of people who are a minority within a society does not mean they're unfit to parent or to exist, and gender fluidity cannot and should not be used as an exercise to violate human rights. Now, the writer of this piece says that, he says, and he, all the words are spelled out, this is just effing wrong, period. Take your heads out of your arse, deal with your bigotry and fear, and then come to the realization that no one has the right to demand another undergo castration because you, that's right, you have issues. And don't even give me that BS about your concern for children either. They're the convenient excuse, always the excuse, when you're talking about abortion or adoption or transsexuals. When it comes right down to it, the writer says, people don't really care about kids, or so many of them wouldn't be living in poverty. And then, it's all about the kiddies. So the final thought is that forced castration is just plain huge in every way, wrong and despicable. Now, speaking of our trans friends in Maryland, religious conservatives are starting a referendum with Montgomery County. There was a Montgomery County law in Maryland, Montgomery County, Maryland, that protected transgender people. And it's under attack, a repeal measure similar to other measures that are across the country to make it any advancement of LGBT folks impossible. The Montgomery County Council members unanimously approved a measure last fall that prohibits discrimination against transgendered people in housing. It means you get to live somewhere. Employment, it means you get to earn a living. Public accommodations means you get to check into a hotel. Taxi cabs mean you can get back and forth to work. And yes, even cable service has been denied to LGBT or trans people because the installer was, I don't want to go in there. There's queers and trans people in there. I don't want to go in there and hook up no cable. So the good folks of Montgomery County Council unanimously approved a measure that prohibited discrimination against trans people in those areas, very basic areas of human existence. And you don't have to live under a bridge and you can have a job. And council members also included an exemption for personal and private places, but nonetheless, the local conservatives were just incensed. They brought up the fact that men are going to be allowed into the women's bathrooms and the locker rooms, and they're going to see our little girls. Because, you know, the men, you know, the good Christian men that they all know and associate with are just poor enough to pretend to be a woman to go in there and look at the little girl. So since they do it, since they risk it, they project it onto other people. Anyway, the local group Citizens for Responsible Government ran a successful petition drive to get the 25,000 signatures required to put the law on the county's November ballot for possible recall. And, of course, this is being funded by the national conservative group Focus on the Family, who is helping out with the Montgomery issue. The Focus on the Family is battling Colorado's transgender law also, along with other groups. That's right, folks. And Focus on the Family ran radio and print ads focusing on one thing. One thing only, I tell you, bathroom access. The men are going to go in there and look at our little girls. What a bunch of. There's some. They also point out they're concerned about Montgomery County, of course, in Colorado and Gainesville, Florida. There's a trans law now in Gainesville, Florida. Gainesville, Florida, by the way, is just south of Tallahassee. The University of Florida is in Gainesville. And they're facing a similar referendum in Gainesville for a similar law. And he says, this is precisely what the transgender community ultimately wants, to open up the bathrooms. I'm sure that all of our transgender brothers and sisters just stay up late at night thinking about getting into them damn bathrooms. Jesus Christ. It's a cesspool, I tell you. It is a cesspool. The transgender rights advocates, of course, say the bills are about ensuring no one's denied a meal at a restaurant or an apartment because of gender issues. It is not about bathroom access. In fact, the law reads, and I'll repeat it, housing, employment, public accommodations, taxi cab, cable service. But it's the bathrooms, I tell you. They want to see our little girls. The LGBT rights activists are calling it a campaign of fear and misinformation. This is, of course, very typical, and this is always the case. It is always a campaign of fear and misinformation. It is difficult to fight lies, and it is difficult to keep up with it when you just go on. You say anything you want. You make up any facts you want. Base it on the Dutch study. Hell, everybody will buy that. Transgender is new to a lot of people, and they want to get into the bathrooms, says the wackos. Anyway, just some more information about some other states, but basically it's a story about Maryland. So that's that. And Again, remind you, it's a highly irregular version of Strictly Confidential this evening, done by telephone in hand, without the aid of any sort of internet devices. I can't begin to tell you how weird this is, but that's just the way it goes. It's about time we headed on over to the gay bar across the street. The DJ at the gay bar across the street is none other than the world's most dangerous yet somehow lovable DJ, Mr. Larry Sanders from California. And Larry's site is morningstarmelody.com, and the proceeds go to support children's charities. You can read about the children's charities there at his website, morningstarmelody.com. And this particular segment that we're about to hear is from Larry's Mix Magnificat mix set, which you can find out about there at morningstarmelody.com. So as we gather up our umbrellas and our raincoats and our galoshes, we'll head across the dirt road to the gay bar across the street.
Across the alley was the Paradise Dance Hall. Evenings in spring, they'd open all the doors and windows and the music would come outside. Sometimes they'd turn out all the lights except for a large glass sphere that hung from the ceiling. It would turn slowly about and filter the dusk with delicate rainbow colors.
And my friends, that was none other than Mr. Larry Sanders from California, the world's most dangerous yet somehow lovable DJ, Mr. Larry Sanders. You can find out more about Larry's music at MorningstarMelody.com. I have a little story that I'm going to share with you. Larry doesn't know I'm going to tell this, but I am. At the San Francisco Gay Pride, which is, of course, huge. Some might call it the Gay Pride event in the country. There were various DJs stationed at various places along the way and played for a period of time after or during the parade and people danced. So one of the DJs, in any case, contacted Larry and told Larry that he had decided to play only Larry Sanders remixes at the Gay Pride Parade. And the segment was supposed to run 1 hour, but he couldn't get rid of the people. And they stated he ended up playing Larry Sanders remixes exclusively for 4 hours, which I think is absolutely fabulous. Couldn't be prouder to have Larry Sanders as one of our DJs here on Strictly Confidential. There will be a all foxed up this evening at midnight. There will be a horn section immediately following this show, and there will be a Strictly Confidential tomorrow night, whether the Internet is fixed or not. We have a special music guest, Amuka. So in closing, here's Cynthia Manley reminding you to...